This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today is March 31st, 2015. Now, I want to ask you guys, have you been wondering what it would be like to be here at this time, March 31st? This is a very magical time of the year. We've all talked about this for months and months and months. What was it going to be like around the spring equinox? And here we are today, and there are some major gurglings going on about military factions and SEAL factions getting ready and militia stepping up and martial law, which, by the way, I think is total garbage. I just want everybody to know that a lot of intel and a lot of messages have come forth through many of us who are either psychic or clairvoyant. We are all receiving the same thing, that we are literally on the threshold of something fantastic about to go down. So just want to remind you, hang in there, hang tough. Don't get caught up in the fear porn, everybody, because there's a lot of it going around. And there is an awful lot of the documents being released, which are showing what the government's been really doing to all of us around the world. So who better to bring on on board today than our very up-and-coming, quick-rising star, Mark Sargent. Seriously, I cannot believe it's very interesting because I did not set up this radio show. My husband very much pursued this because he's been pursuing research on the Flat Earth for quite some time. I think you guys remember last summer we put a very comprehensive interview together about some of the things that we had, you know, uncovered, and we were blown away. Just the concept of being on a flat earth. We'd heard about it, but we didn't really embrace it until we started really diving into some of the details. So today what I thought I'd do is kind of turn it around. It's funny because last week's interview, the gentleman that I interviewed, Sheldon Neidel, doesn't really believe in the flat earth. And so we've got all kinds of different opinions and viewpoints here today. But Mark has some very interesting, pretty convincing arguments, if you want to call it that. And if for those of you who are not following him, he's just kind of came out on the internet with a flare. He is from Whidbey Island, Washington. That sounds pretty.
It is pretty.
I bet. He was born in Seattle, grew up in South Whidbey Island, and founded the Brimstone Fireworks Company. And I just cracked up. It was shut down by the ATF in his junior year. Aw.
Yep. Yeah. If you're not getting in trouble, if you're not getting in trouble in college, you're not trying, in my opinion.
I just cracked up. He spent 3 years as a sous chef at a Greek restaurant and won the first computer pinball award tournament in 1994. He was hired by a PC game publisher in Boulder, Colorado, which I think is now where you are.
I'm here.
Same entire year, and played computer games for a living. Oh, gee, that's tough.
It's a rough life.
1997. He stayed in the Boulder technology sector ever since. And he's never been married, never had kids, which actually there's a lot of us around, by the way, that do that. And most of his extensive time is spent on trying to unravel the hidden truths of civilization and what I would say conspiracy and the never-ending search for the meaning of itself. If I had to pick a single motto, Mark says, it would be hope for the best and prepare for the worst. A close second would be don't regret what you've done, regret what you haven't, which I totally agree with. So anyway, with that said, welcome, everybody. You are attending an interview with GalacticConnection.com. Forgot to even say that. Please visit my website at GalacticConnection.com/daily-blog. You will be accessing the largest online library of articles, events, news, education, conspiratorial uncoverings, everything from quantum physics to spirituality. So we've got quite a bit to show you if you take a little walk up to Galactic Connections website. So anyway, Mark, thank you for coming on today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You are welcome. And as anybody may notice who are really heavily involved in the Flat Earth theory, People are going to notice Mark's been really getting a lot of coverage as of late. And he and I were just talking about, isn't it interesting that literally overnight there's been a flurry of information and people connecting with one another regarding the flat Earth? There's no accident to this.
No, it can't be. I've never seen such traction over a topic that should not be getting any traction whatsoever.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm also noticing, which we'll bring up later, that there's a little bit of friction amongst the flat earther people.
Little bit, but as of today, that may be mending.
Good. I'm glad to see that. We don't need that.
No, we don't. And just let me know when you want me to talk about that, and I'm more than happy to let you know what the progress is.
We'll dive into that.
Okay.
So what I really want to start out with is, why do we see the same picture in every classroom, in every book, every science book, from the time that we were educated from very, very young age? Why do we see the same picture of the Earth?
Because it's the only picture they ever released. It is the strangest thing you'd ever expect, but from 19, and it really depends when you date stamp that picture, and everybody knows what picture I'm talking about. That is a very cloudy Earth with the bottom part of Africa and all of what they're proposing is Antarctica with a big crescent cloud shape next to it. They put that thing out there in either the late 60s or the early 70s, and that was the only picture that NASA ever produced, and all the way up until at least 2000 and probably the mid-2000s. It was amazing. I looked for more 15 years ago back in the year 2000, and literally people don't understand that if you did like a Google image search or just a general internet image search, that's all you got, was just rows and rows and rows of the same picture. And that's how good for me this thing was, as far as, you know, how big and how deep it was, because no one even noticed it. Everyone was like, oh, just NASA's just crappy at their job.
Yeah.
You know, they had no idea that, no, that's the only picture they're going to release until somebody, until the composites started coming out.
Well, and that's my next question is, so the composite of the Earth, how many pictures is that a composite of?
You mean how many composites are there right now? There's hundreds. And as a matter of fact, ever since Google Earth came into effect, which is just one giant 3D movable composite image, that really took over, from that point on, because people are just taking screenshots of Google Earth. So that just fills up the internet. But by all means, anybody who wants to go out to YouTube, there's videos. There's people that dedicate – I haven't dedicated videos entirely to it, but there's people that dedicate videos to just showing all the different rows of composites, thousands at this point. And you can spot them. They're real easy. And even NASA will release composites, and they're not shy about saying, oh, yeah, they're composites, because most people do not ask, well, what are the real shots from space? And as far as – now, that's still images. What's more interesting, though, is, try to find actual video of the Earth from space. Then it gets all,
right?
Very, very tough to find. And if you do find something that's revolving, you get the early stuff that they released didn't have any clouds morphing, and that – was caught almost immediately by the internet hive mind. So, yeah, they can't get away with much nowadays.
So clarify for the audience why the Earth is composited in the first place.
The Earth is composited in the first place. I'll be as blunt as I can here, because the Earth isn't what you think it is. It is not this shape. It has never been this shape. In fact, for the first 4,500 years of our existence, it was not this shape. It was considered a flattish, enclosed disk system. And 500 years ago, it all of a sudden became this. And then for 20 generations, we were pushing this in the classrooms. So the composite images they were desperate. We got to a point where once the internet started going high speed, once we abandoned modems and went high speed, you had to release composite images. No different than why you had to create the space program, but you had to create the composite images because otherwise, more and more people would notice, like me. If you want an image, I'll give you a quick example. The iPhone, the default, that globe picture on the iPhone. I can't remember which version it was, but that is a composite image. And the reason why the guy created it for the, you know, for the phone was because he couldn't find any decent images out there. So he had to create his own. And there's interviews on that. He was interviewed, you know, and there's videos on YouTube you can find. It's great.
So what exactly happened 500 years ago to have changed the concept of the Earth being flat with four squared corners?
Yeah.
To actually being a globe. What exactly happened at that point?
It changed from the proverbial four corners of the Earth model 500 years ago. Copernicus really was the one that's credited for it. And truth was, yeah, in fact, even his stuff wasn't released until after he had passed away. He had sat on it because he's, you know, it is a huge leap of faith. You think, people that are watching this, you think it's a leap of faith to go from this to a flat model. Imagine 500 years ago when all of history thought it was a flat model and you had to make a leap to this by saying that, okay, if we wrap this around a ball and have it spinning at 1,000 miles an hour and then have moving that around the sun at 60,000 miles an hour, then it's a globe. It's a massive leap of faith. It's a huge leap of faith. But it caught on, especially in the science community, and then the religious groups had to sort of bend with it because it is such a big change between a globe and a flat model that religion didn't want to, you know, be left behind. Let's say religion was wrong. You know, they were going, nah, let's go with this. You know, it's still in our books. Well, let's go with this. And so they, you know, religion said, whatever. God created the globe, you know, just the same as he created a flat sphere. Therefore, we'll move forward with it. And so everybody was on board. But the problem was you couldn't prove it. Yeah. There was no physical, I mean, and not like today's experiments, you know, where it takes us, you know, 10 or 20 years to prove something out.
Yeah.
No. These guys were centuries away from proving it. Balloons weren't going to be around for another 200 years. The first planes weren't going to be around for another 400 years. Rocket technology wasn't going to be around till almost 460 years later. And that's when you first, you know, got a chance to take a picture, when you could go high enough and find out what it really looked like. So the dilemma is, once you got high enough to take the picture, if it didn't look like this, and you'd already been preaching this in the schools and in universities for the last 20 generations, who are you gonna tell people? You gonna let that out of the bag? You know, because you're at that point. There's a big shift in, and I cover this in some of my videos. A big shift in spirituality and how mankind looks at the world and each other. And it's a big roll of the dice. And, you know, if you know the authority and you know the power structure, it's like, man, you know, we'll have to take three steps back before we can get this under control again. So they made the decision not to.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you was, if you go back to the biblical part of things, okay?
Yep.
And it says, and God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light.
Yep.
That it was good, and God divided light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness be called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. Now get this. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide, here's the clue, guys, the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And And it was so, and God divided the firmament. So, what's your interpretation of that?
Oh, that's a great interpretation, and I use that most often because it's the most recognizable. I mean, it's Genesis, and not only is it the first book of the King James, not only is it, I know I hate to do this because other religions are going to yell at me, not only is it the first book of the King James Bible, but it is also the first chapter. So you can't go any further back than that, which is, again, why religion would absolutely latch on to this. All religions would latch on to this. You know, I've got a wonderful PDF document that covers every culture. Every culture talks about this.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, and not just the big five religions, but your tribal religions. Every native indigenous population all over the world, they all had the same, you know, same sort of belief, and that was a solid, immovable structure covered by some sort of canopy that displays everything we see in the sky, and it was a wonderful thing. As a matter of fact, the first ones that even got away from that, from what I was reading recently, with the Chinese in 200 AD, and they were considered nutso at the time when they did it, because everybody else were going, what are you kidding? Why would you ever, think about this? But it's an interesting, and what I thought was also interesting about that was the waters from the waters, because several people have said to me, as far as an enclosed system goes, what's on the outside of it? And it's like, is it possible that it literally is water on the outside? Could we actually be in an enclosed structure in an ocean somewhere? It's like, that's very possible.
It's funny you say that, Mark, because through my investigations and the amount of reading that I've done in the past, the research, it really seems to me that dark matter is, and they've referred to this,
yeah,
as kind of a black ocean.
Yeah.
And it's actually referred to as that in some of the ancient script. The other thing is, by opening the door to this theory, we are really having to look at ourselves completely different internally.
Yes.
Because now, once again, we're back to, we're the center of the universe. And now, not from an egotistical standpoint.
Yeah.
It's really more about a spiritual journey. And what are we going to do when we find out who we really are, which is what I think this kind of leads to, is who are we really?
But, Agreed.
So what did you think about, it says here even that the Hebrews considered the sun and the moon to be the small bodies near to the earth, and it's clear in Joshua 10:12. Now, granted, God, everybody knows I'm not a big Bible guru or a Bible thumper of any means, but I thought it was interesting to bring the correlation back to the biblical aspects.
Yeah.
It gives it specific localities in which it stood still. And this is in Isaiah. It says, quote, God sits throned on the vaulted roof of earth, mm-hmm, whose inhabitants are like grasshoppers. And in the book of Job, it says, God walks to and fro on the vault of heaven.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the firmament, what exactly is that? What have you found that to be?
From everything that I have seen, it appears to be a very solid, and I know I overuse it, but I'm going to keep using it because everyone can relate to it, a Truman Show-like enclosure that seems to be impenetrable. It seems to be fairly high, although the height is really disputed. For me, 400 kilometers high could just be about fine, but other people say, it's higher, but it encloses the whole thing. I'll throw the Isaiah quote, or another Isaiah quote, to you. He who sits upon the circle of the earth, doesn't say the ball, doesn't say the globe, the circle. But as far as the firmament is concerned, a very, very large structure that may be being projected on from the outside as far as the planets and the stars are concerned. But to your point, the sun and the moon seem to be separate from that. And for me, and I know, again, I know there's some dispute in the flat earth circles. For me, I go with the traditional flat model, which says they're three-dimensional objects which spin around the circle and, then adjust themselves according to the seasons.
Interesting. So do you agree that the sun and the moon are the same size?
It's very possible. It's extremely possible. Why
do you say that?
Well, let's look at the eclipses for one. The moon slides over the sun, perfectly, coincidentally.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and also don't think they didn't notice that you can only see exactly one side of the moon. Why they didn't get that thing rotating, I have no idea. But it just feels right. When you look at the two during any sort of eclipse, it seems, I know it's going to sound silly, but it seems like they could be possibly the same size, even though they say the sun is 92 million miles away and the moon is 237,000 miles away. But yeah, I'd say very possibly it's the same size.
Which leads into, for anyone who hasn't followed Mark Sargent's video series, you want to tell them where to find him?
Oh, you don't have to look hard now.
You don't.
All you have to do is Google flat Earth clues, and it'll come up. I apparently am the only one using that term until somebody trademarks it. And it's on YouTube, but you don't even have to go to YouTube if you want. But that's the only place you can find them at the moment. Well, except for all the mirrors, because I put a little thing in there. I said, please feel free to share these videos, and people have just mirrored these things
That's good. That's the way to get the awareness up. And
Yeah.
you're now up to the 11th one. I noticed it was released just recently. Do you have a 12th one percolating?
12th one is in the works right now. The 11th one was called Souls in the System. The 12th one is called Real Eyes, Real Space Eyes. And I am still working on that one. That one's about the power of illusion, and I want to make sure I get that one right before I release it. So I'm not gonna throw filler up. I mean, I've released a ton of content already, in a short amount of time. I don't know where most of it came from. It was like a bolt out of the blue. I just woke up, and it's like, I've got to do this. And I had a
Gee, I wonder who that could be.
I had no seriously, I had
How
a
long
Jerry.
ago? How long ago did this start with you, Mark?
It's embarrassing to say how short it was.
Tell
Less than 7 weeks.
her. 7 weeks, guys.
And in fact, I don't think it's even
How many
7 weeks.
total videos have you made already?
I made the intro and then 11 clues, so 12 of those, three trailers, and there's six interviews already up on the channel. Another one's supposed to be shipped to me here pretty soon, and then everything else this week. So
Okay, so
yeah.
7 weeks, we're talking 16 videos about and six interviews. And you're wondering why you woke up one day and you said to yourself, "Oh my God, why do I have to do this?" That's the way spirit works. And the timing
Apparently.
is incredibly excellent for this to be being released, which is one of the reasons I felt compelled to do it. Now, with that said, I'd like to talk a little bit about why people would even believe that the Earth is not round. I thought it would be really cool to go into the whole thing about the measuring of the dip of the Earth.
Sure.
How they say that the first mile is 8 inches. Can you go into that kind of thing?
I can. I try to. I got to be honest, though. I try to avoid the old arguments about why the Earth, isn't round, because the arguments don't go anywhere. As far as the amount of dip per, what is it, 6 miles? I have had so many people come back. Honestly, the consensus is almost like there is no consensus, because I know the old test, that was done years ago was like, okay, every 6 miles there should be like a 16-foot drop, and I have seen that test, but at the same time, other people have said it's less than that, it's like less than half, and now other people said it's more. And the point I was getting at, as and before I released these videos, I was bouncing around, certain things, and I was going, you know what, these are arguments that generally don't go anywhere. So I tried to go with the bigger broad strokes that nobody had ever talked about. But I know where you're going on this. And for yes, tests have been done in the past, and people will argue on both sides. But unfortunately, the arguments, if you get too many nerds in one room, before 10 minutes is out, you're wondering what formula you're talking about, and it's like, okay, which you don't even know which side really to root for at that point, because it's just everything gets lost in math.
I'm giggling because I'm sitting here thinking, are you a nerd, Mark?
I'm looking at all the comic book art that sits around my place. I used to own a comic book shop years and years ago, and so I remember the movie Unbreakable with Samuel L. Jackson and Bruce Willis. Samuel Jackson being the comic book artist shop owner. Yeah, that was it. Still is me to a certain degree, but you don't see that behind me. So yeah, I am a very much a nerd.
So, do you agree that the lighthouses, you can actually see a lighthouse 100 miles away? Have they proven that beyond a shadow of a doubt? I mean, I know you can clearly see them, so they use that as one of their arguments to prove that this is truly a flat Earth.
As much as I'd like to endorse them, what I try to tell people is like, look, there are a bunch of YouTube videos out. In fact, there's more coming out like every day now, which is
It's
fantastic.
amazing. It's like overnight, guys.
Yeah,
Don't do this.
when I go into YouTube and I say flat earth and then I say today or this week, I see players now that they came out of nowhere, and they're like, we're talking about. So to that point, anyone that wants to go out and see videos where people literally, because the big test, you have to go down to a beach somewhere and set up your camera and fire it off, you know, between 1 and 4 feet high and see how far you can go. And there's some very interesting videos out there of people taking long range or fairly long range, you know, videos, because our cameras have gotten so much better.
Yeah.
And they are seeing distances which really aren't showing much of a drop. So it is, that is very, very interesting. Yeah, go figure.
Well, and you know what? For so many of us who intrinsically kind of have a knowingness about this reality, this matrix,
yeah,
doesn't take a whole lot to talk us into it. But yeah, you're still having those out there, the naysayers that, you know, I got to have the scientific proof. And the unfortunate thing is, just by me diving into all the details to this, I'm finding that those theories and those tests, those diagnostic tests that they've used to try to prove that the Earth is not round, you know, they're arguing about whether those tests are legitimate, because it's the starting point from which you decide to do a test.
Agreed. Yeah. Is there such a thing as an objective test in that? Yeah, because you're already skewing it before you even start. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's absolutely, like, how do we go there? So talk about vacuum. I think that's a really good subject.
Is there a vacuum? Are we gonna delve into the ether argument?
Yes.
After that, okay. Because I am actually brushed up on that because of you.
Oh, good.
Believe it or not.
Well, take it away.
Okay. So vacuum, from, you know, there is an argument out there, and that is, if we are in space, and space has a vacuum, and vacuum is nothing, and, you know, and air, you know, we know full well that air will rush into a vacuum. Wouldn't it take a heck of a lot of gravity to keep the atmosphere that we have on the planet? Wouldn't the air, you know, wouldn't the atmosphere just blow right off? You know, or wouldn't you get to that point, kind of like what they call the pop point, where you're getting, you know, if you're, as you're leaving the atmosphere, wouldn't you get to that point between atmosphere and a vacuum, and, you know, you would pop through it? And, but that argument doesn't hold, you know, for me, doesn't hold much weight either, because it's like, it's, you know, there's a real good point there. And that is, from a vacuum standpoint, wouldn't the vacuum, especially in a giant expanse of space, which we're supposedly in, wouldn't that pull, you know, have a tremendous pulling force on the atmosphere that we have? And I think it's a great argument. It's an old argument, but it's a good one, in my opinion.
So basically, where we sit is those that believe in gravity.
Yeah.
So, and those that don't, can you talk a little bit about that? And, you know, what that has to do with it?
Gravity, yeah, and people can look this up online. Gravity is one of the most confusing things, even in a globe. Gravity is confusing no matter where you are. It doesn't matter if it's an enclosed system or if it's in a globe system. And I know that, you know, some people say, oh, no, gravity's easy. It's great. It's based on mass and density. However, you know, if you look deeper into it, most scientists will say, yeah, gravity is one of those things we really haven't nailed down yet. So, for me, from an enclosed standpoint, gravity is easily manipulated. Let's put it that way. In an enclosed model, some people will say, you know, on a flat model, some people will say, well, you know, it's still based on density, and you can do it like, which is fine. But for me, since everything seems to be artificial, then gravity should be artificial too. And by that, I mean some sort of molecular magnetism. You know, yes, you know, right now magnetism is limited to metals and electricity, and it seems very, very limited. But what if it wasn't? What if you could magnetize things on a molecular level? Couldn't you simulate something like, oh, I don't know, gravity? It'd be pretty easy to do once you got that point. And people say, no, that's impossible. It's like, really? Heavier than air flight was impossible. And if somebody built a structure this big, do you really think that anything is out of bounds for this group? I highly doubt it.
I thought Dubé had a really interesting statement when he said, if there really was such a thing as gravity, then and we're spinning at the rate that they're claiming that we're spinning, that we would literally need like those big moon boots, you know, to make sure that we're locked down. If we're spinning and everything else is spinning, you know, how do we stay on? He says, you know, the gravity is just such the classic easy way of explaining this whole thing away.
Yeah.
So
and Eric Dubé and I have we agree on a lot of points, lot of points. And I just found out recently that he and I may not be as far off as we had thought. You know, there was, yes, some absolute. Can I address that?
Sure, go for it.
For those of you that have been following the Flat Earth circles, there has been a little bit of friction between Eric and I because we disagree on what I consider to be some fairly minor points. However, look, from my point of view, we're all on the same team. You know, we're still anti-globe, and I have nothing bad to say about the man at all. Never have, never will. I followed some of his videos before I got into this, and when you search Flat Earth, his videos will come up first. At least today they are. And, you know, he's got a lot of good stuff out there. So, yeah, listen to him. You know, I know that he'll say, I don't know if he's done it on video where he said, oh, Mark, he's an imposter, he's horrible. But, you know, he and I are actually, where I think we're, for the most part, we're in the same camp. But he has an excellent point about gravity. And he's also right about the moon boot argument. For me, it's that simple argument that people can get their head around, and that is, look, like a merry-go-round, this thing's spinning at 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, but if you're standing on the North Pole in a globe, you're spinning at 0 miles an hour. So there's no pull at all. So if you put a 100-pound weight on the North Pole and then took it down to the equator, yeah, it may not weigh 10 pounds less, but it's going to weigh a little bit less because centrifugal force is going to try to pull that thing off. And people will say, well, no, it's not. No, it's going to be measurable. Don't tell me it's not going to be measurable. We've got devices now that can measure anything. So, you know, it's absolutely in my, you know, something that should be discussed.
Well, even Steve wanted me to put this out there. It says, if you suck all the air out of a jar, a vacuum jar, and you put sand in it, it would drop to the bottom of the jar. And it says, you know, tell us, would we just float out into space? You don't float when you're in a vacuum.
I don't know if I have an opinion on that because I don't know if I can get my head around it yet. So is he talking about if we knocked all the atmosphere off Earth, that's the argument? Would we go cascading off into space? Depends if you're talking about air pressure, you know, is the linchpin that's holding us down at that point?
Well, who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
How do we know any of this? Because they have so much technology that we aren't even aware of. Plus, we live in an artificial intelligent matrix. So God only knows, even everything we see, we don't really know that that's either real or an illusion.
Oh, absolutely. No? And more to your point, by the way, if that is also the case, and I don't really touch on that because it was too easy to go down the matrix of the 13th floor argument. And I absolutely agree with you on this. But if you want to go down that argument, then literally you're talking about a programming simulation, in which case gravity is literally what they tell it to be.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be no different than a video game. You know, characters have, you know, can jump up and down in a video game. They have gravity because it's built in. You know, they want to make it 10 times as hard, or, you know, make it one, you know, a fifth as easy. Oh, yeah. Easily. So
basically, it could be just another program.
Yep.
You know, the other thing I thought that was really a good point was we've been told for so long that we're just this little insignificant planet out on the outer, you know, orbit of this solar system, kind of out in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
But yet it says here, God said that we are the center of the universe and cannot be moved. 1,500 years ago, everyone knew that we were the center of the universe.
Yep.
And that's just wild. We tend to look at 1,500 years ago and think, oh, they were so archaic and they were so non-educated and, you know, so non-evolved. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, but when the globe was created 500 years ago, what they did was they really isolated everybody, because they made this just this little speck of dust in the middle of nowhere. I mean, people, you know, felt, you want to talk about feeling insignificant, the globe did it.
That's a good point.
If you go back to an enclosed system, which we may talk about later, Everything becomes way more intimate. And, this giant, massive, structure all of a sudden becomes a one or two bedroom apartment, you know, for some people.
That's a good point. Well, now you started out, like, one of your very first series was talking about the film industry and Hollywood and the impact that they've had on this whole topic. Can you talk a little bit about Room 237?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you bet. Room 237.
And why was it called 237?
Room 237 was a documentary made about, and there are some people that say, you know, because there's, you know, everything in Hollywood is in pairs. So if, for those who are a fan of 237, you'll like it. But there are other people that say that, oh, you got to go watch Kubrick's Odyssey instead. Really, you know, by the time you finish it, you're going to get about the same message. But what it's about is that Stanley Kubrick, who started the movie 2001, he started producing it in 1963, which coincidentally was the same time that NASA started up the Apollo programs. And he worked on it 5 years, and the Apollo program, you know, really started doing their thing, you know, shortly after the release of his movie. And the rumor was, and I believe it absolutely, that Kubrick was signed on to work for the Department of Defense because he was what they considered the best guy at reproducing technology that hadn't existed yet, which he proved with 2001: A Space Odyssey. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's 1968. It is still, in my opinion, probably the finest space simulation movie. The moon footage of that movie, when you're going to the moon, you're looking at it and you're going, that's the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen. You know, and for 1968, it blew me away. So the rumor is that he was hired on as the Department of Defense to see what was possible in film to be recreated for a space program. What can you simulate in film? And they gave him an unlimited budget, and he worked on it for 5 years. Again, what studio would ever let a director go for 5 years, except for that thing that was done last year? But
that's,
you know,
true.
with unlimited money, and
crazy.
But supposedly he was soured by the whole experience. I mean, you work for the government for that long. Eventually, you're going to figure out, you know, the intentions. And it's like being a creative artist. He's like, you know what? I don't like digging this. Unfortunately, he couldn't get out of it. So he had to finish his movie, turn over all his tech to them, and then they went forward with the Apollo program. Well, what was interesting was, you like anyone, you know, you want to confess, but you can't. You know, you can't tell anybody. So what he did was, and again, you have to watch it to be sure, but in 1980, he built his confession into code, and he set it into the movie The Shining with Jack Nicholson in 1980. And it was, again, everybody missed it. It was one of those things, you know, he was brilliant enough that he knew that eventually, and I think he died in 1999, and shortly after, you know, he finished Eyes Wide Shut. And people didn't figure it out. I think they didn't even pay attention until after he died. You know, it's like the mystery of Stanley Kubrick, and they started looking into it. And in that movie, there's this wonderful scene, and it's got the main documentary is called Room 237, because 237 is 237,000 miles from the Earth to the Moon. And there's, I'm not going to do it justice. You really got to watch the documentary, but there's some wonderful stuff in it where, you know, the room key is an anagram for moon room. You know, how he designed the room key. The fact that the kid is wearing an Apollo 11 handmade sweater, and he stands up during this one scene, and you realize, you know, most people, he didn't even catch it, the guy of the documentary. It's like, look, this kid's wearing an Apollo 11 sweater, right? The kid's maybe, what, 6 years old, right? And this was 1980 movie. So when did his mother make this sweater for him exactly? You know, little things, and how the room, basically the analogy was that everything in the moon room, which was room 237, was fake. that was the whole thing. Everything was an illusion, but it was this beautiful dream, how it started out with a beautiful woman that turned into this nightmare. And which, you know, and he just, you could see everything. There's little things he put throughout the hotel that just kept referencing it back, little anagrams here and there. And it was brilliant, brilliantly done. And,
you know,
again,
it just goes to show you that Hollywood has many purposes.
Yeah.
But one of the most significant is what they're talking about now, which is soft disclosure. And unfortunately, they'll put a little bit of a negative spin on it. But when I was reading Room 237, which I unfortunately have not seen yet, I really want to make sure I do.
Sure.
When I was reading the description of it, I thought, well, how clever is that? So they got a budget for 5 years so that they could check out how they could present this information to the public.
Yeah.
What better way to do it than to presented on widescreen amongst the public.
Yeah.
Make money off of it.
Yeah.
And figure out what was the best way to do it, because we already know that they embed subliminals in the movies.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was just
probably the most expensive and early versions of predictive programming you could ever do. And it was perfect. It was, you know, it was released 68 and then 69, it was already, you know, it already started in people's heads. It's like, oh yeah, the moon missions, and they were already reinforced by 2001: A Space Odyssey. It was great.
Incredible. Well, yeah. I do remember the right stuff. Now, you were saying that basically the Apollo missions had never been touched.
No, they weren't. And I'm a media junkie, and I should know.
Can you talk about that just for a few minutes? Just
yeah.
That's really huge.
I don't know why, but most people, for whatever reason, blew right by that. They're saying, oh, yeah, fine, NASA's discredited, move on to the next clues. I'm going, guys, you don't understand. Okay. It's like Hollywood makes movies about everything. If there's a nickel to be made in Hollywood, they will make – I mean, you've seen the movie. I mean, they're redoing Paul Bart Mall Cop this summer, you know. They make movies about everything. They will milk it until literally they do not make money again. And you're talking about the greatest achievement in the history of the civilization, right? And they waited. The first movie they ever made was in 1983, which was The Right Stuff. And again, brilliant cast, very long movie, three hours and 12 minutes. And it was really just an astronaut training program movie. And it was set up perfectly for a sequel. Made a ton of money. Nominated for – it won a bunch of Academy Awards. I think it was nominated for Best Picture but lost to Gandhi. And it was set up for a sequel, because at the end of those 3 hours, it was like, oh, okay, we've just barely gotten to low Earth orbit. Perfect. Let's do a sequel. Never happened. And then nothing in that genre happened again until 1995 with Apollo 13, and that was really just shot inside the space capsule. You know, that was out of all the six missions, let's do the one that doesn't land on the moon, you know, that gets in trouble. Oh, let's fix things with air ducts and, you know, wiring. Let's get, you know, and again, great cast, also, you know, very, very well reviewed and you know, very well. And then after that, nothing.
Any comments from the actors and actresses about this? That allude to maybe them knowing?
No, as a matter of fact, well, you know, a little side note, it's like Ron Howard, when he was asking for, you know, because he likes to do his homework, he tried to ask for the all the data stuff on the Apollo missions, and that was when they NASA admitted to them, oh yeah, by the way, we lost thousands and thousands of all the telemetry tapes, and so did our subcontractors simultaneously. And people are like, what happened there? But so Ron, you know, Ron went and finished the movie anyway. But Tom Hanks was a big supporter of the moon missions, so he went and did his own little pay channel, and I can't remember which network it was, a little mini series called From the Earth to the Moon.
Yeah,
and and again, he was, and I mentioned it because I had to mention it. But literally, the reason why I mentioned it was, if it wasn't for him, it wouldn't have gotten made. And that was the last production of any kind. Forget about Hollywood movies. There was no movies. There was no media on the subject made. And it's 2015 now. And nobody's touching it. And the reason why they're not touching it is because it hits too close to home. And you can't let that movie get made. You can't. It blurs the lines too much because if a Hollywood movie makes a Hollywood studio makes a movie and they call it the Moon Missions, right? And they, you know, big cast and all this. By the time they're done with that production, and you compare it side by side, because that's what the internet would do now. If you compare it side by side with the actual production, people get this weird, creepy feeling as they're watching it, going, "Well, wait a minute." You know, and the same thing with everyone that produced it, you know, because Hollywood has those big production teams, and as they'd be making it, the production teams would get this funny feeling, and, you know, they just didn't want to risk it, which is why I mentioned Capricorn One. You know, that movie could not be made today. In 1979, absolutely. It was an independent film. Other people don't understand. That was not, no Hollywood studio picked that up. That was an independent film made by a CBS television producer.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And they're all essentially kind of poking holes at the whole moon mission endeavor, aren't they?
Ultimately. Which one?
Capricorn 1 as well.
Oh, God. Oh, Capricorn 1. Yeah. The backstory behind that was there was a CBS television studio producer, guy that worked in the studio, and he was old enough, or he'd been there long enough that when they were doing the second generation transmissions from NASA in the early 70s, he was part of that. So it was coming through his studio, and he was going, "This is some of the worst production I've ever seen." You know, not from a debunking standpoint. It's not that he thought that the moon missions were fake. He was just going, "That's just terrible quality from an entertainment standpoint." So he goes,
"Yeah,
I could
bought it."
Well, yeah, he's going, "I could make a better thing than that. In fact, I could make a better Mars mission than they did a moon mission." And he did. And when you watch Capricorn 1, there's some, you know, especially now, if you're a conspiracy person, if you haven't watched Capricorn 1 yet, oh, it gives you weird goosebumps because...
I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen either one of these.
You have not watched Capricorn 1 ever?
I have. Oh. I haven't.
Oh, you'll love it. And I won't ruin it for you because there's a plot twist and you'll dig it.
I will. I'm looking forward to it. Well, now let's go back in time a little bit. You know, I noticed that you received a little heat from... Eric on this one, and that was the fact that you were bringing up Admiral Byrd.
Yes.
And you kind of started the whole scenario off with he being the Indiana Jones on steroids.
Yeah.
And truly he was, just for everybody to know. I mean, he not only had a Medal of Honor, a silver life-saving medal, a Navy Distinguished Service Medal, a Distinguished Flying Cross, and a Navy Cross.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Boy, the man could snap a Christmas tree with the amount of stuff that was on his chest. Absolutely.
That blew my mind. And the thing that now, of course, many of us question all the history that we read today because it's all manipulated. But when you have that many medals, and apparently he was really esteemed for being very heroic and actually saving a lot of other people's lives. He wasn't just trying to be in the background dictating, "Hey, boy, you go there and do this, you know, be cannon fodder for me," kind of thing.
Yeah.
But talk to us a little bit about how does Byrd set the stage for the whole flat Earth?
And I'd like to defend, I'm not going to defend Admiral Byrd as much as you might think, because there's a lot of conspiracy people that will say, okay, look, because he was an admiral, and because, combine that he was a Mason, because, you know, that's in his wiki bio,
Sure. Perfectly
fine, that immediately people will say, well, he's part of the system and cannot be trusted. I totally get where you're coming from here. However, from an objective standpoint, there were certain things that he did, and it didn't have to be him. It was just that he was on point. So in my opinion, he was a glorious messenger, meaning he was the one that was going, regardless of what you thought about him as far as being military, and regardless of what you thought about him about, you know, if he was involved in secret societies, he was still the point man when it came to world explorations. You know, he did the North Pole in 1926, and then from 1928 to 1954, he just kept hammering the South Pole.
Yeah.
And it looked like, regardless of whether or not he was in on it, whether more than not he was told that, look, there's something out there, which was why I mentioned the Indiana Jones thing, because there's a lot of little parallels, you know, there that were going on. It's like, look, he's looking for something, and it's obvious that people want him to find it, right?
Yeah.
And
very obvious.
Yeah, very obvious. You know, you don't spend your entire back part of your life in a horrible climate looking for something if you're not under orders, mostly.
Well, not only that, but the 4,700 men.
Oh, yeah. Operation
Down in the expedition and the 13 ships.
Operation High Jump, which was shrouded in mystery to this date. You know, we can speculate all we want about, you know, did they fight Nazis? Did they run into aliens? All over. It's like, you're never going to find that out. No one's going to find that out for sure. But whatever it was, for me, they took care of it. So, you know, because that was in 1946.
Right.
And it seemed to be just, you know, it's like it was a hurdle on the road, absolutely. But by 1954, he became a messenger for what appeared to be the new gold rush, which was he came back to the States.
Interesting.
He was in between missions. The mission he was prepping for was Operation Deep Freeze, which is going to start in 1955. But in 1954, he was doing the circuit around the United States, and he gets on this show on CBS, and he starts talking. And you can look up the YouTube video. It's wonderful. We're so lucky to have it. You know, the
Yeah.
fact that somebody from CBS actually released it.
I know.
And he goes on television, and he basically says Antarctica is the future. It is going to be. We are going to go there. We're going to be there for 100 years at least, and we're just gonna. We're gonna. You know, there's more resources there than the rest of the world combined. You know, he's got, you know, a mountain range made out of coal that can supply the entire world, oil, minerals, uranium. Plus, he hadn't even flown over this big expanse of land that he was talking about. And people are saying, oh, you know, that's disinformation. Oh, it's like, no.
No, that was a live interview.
That was a live. That was a live. Well, it wasn't even just a live interview. It was like, look, if you're into disinformation, the last thing you're going to do is tell the corporations that you're going to be rich. All
Yeah.
right? You're going to make up a different cover story. If you don't want people to go down there, you're going to say, oh, there's nothing there. It's just, or there's, you know, it's there's some toxic thing, or the ground's too salty, or, you know, we found nothing resource-wise. You are not going to come back to the States and say everybody is going to make money.
And
You're not.
he basically alluded that. The other thing, did you notice this? That's on that Long John's, is that how you
The long
say
Longines
it?
chronoscope. Yeah.
Long John's? Yeah. Chronoscope. That was interesting.
Horrible name. Terrible name.
But if you notice that interview, look it up, folks. There's one statement he makes, and he's rattling off all the types of resources that are down there. And he says uranium. And then he backtracks, kind of.
Yeah.
Did you
Yeah, he's
notice
well,
that?
yeah, because he didn't he kind of let the cat out of the bag. He was like going, yeah, it's like maybe we shouldn't, you know, he actually said that too. He's going, yeah, I don't want to talk, because he said we really don't want to fight. I don't want to start a fight down there when it comes to uranium, because, you know, let's face it, at that point, the Soviet Union would have been, wait a minute, uranium? And then they would have been on as well. And so
Yeah, but I
again,
would
there's
think it was also, you know, ETs.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
That's what came to me anyway.
sure. But so it got super strange after that, because after he did the interview, you know, he heads back down there and he does Operation Deep Freeze. And then in my mind, that's when the world changed, because that started a chain of events that to this day still just boggles me, because they were so big. But the Admiral Byrd part of it was that they, even though he talked about all this money that was going to be had down there by everybody, and remember, it wasn't just the United States that was down there. You know, Russia was rebuilding for World War II, Great Britain, Argentina, New Zealand, Australia, everybody was down there.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, everybody stopped doing everything.
Reaching
And
halt.
they said, and not only that, they said, all right, everybody's leaving right now. And you know, again, it was like a horror movie. You know, it's like you run into the monster. It's like, yeah, we're not staying here. And they all leave. And then they put a treaty in place in 1959 that said, and people can look it up, it's still in effect to this day. In fact, it's covered by a secondary treaty, which is environmental, that says no corporation can go down there and do anything, ever. And again, as I'm looking at this, I'm just going, wait, when does that happen? Because every story you ever read, I mean, you can read us daily in the newspapers, you know, about what corporation is trying to do what with the influence that they have. A corporation, especially the petroleum industry, has unlimited lobbying power, unlimited. And
Oh.
they are not even allowed to petition going down there. They can't even talk about it.
See, when you see something that drastic occur, like almost like a light switch, I can pretty much guarantee that it was extraterrestrials. Just almost guaranteed. Because it impacted the entire world. It wasn't just the United States.
No, yeah, yeah.
The Antarctica Treaty, right? And there's, what, 150 different countries? Or how
Well, currently, when it was signed in 1959, it was only the first 10 or 12, depending on which part you read.
Right.
But as every country that became a tradable economic power came on the scene in the world, they were told to sign it. It was like, oh, by the way, you're a relevant country now? Yeah, sign this treaty. And it's like, what do you mean? You're not going down to Antarctica. Really? For how long? You're not going down there. And so now it's, I think, as of today, it might be 52 nations, but they're the 52, you know, economic powers of the world.
Yeah.
But you can be guaranteed that anybody else comes online, they'll all have to sign it.
I agree. And just to kind of bring a little bit of specificity on what he said, these are some of the quotes out of his mouth. Antarctica happens to be the untouched reservoir of natural resources. I thought that was interesting, the wording that he used. It has to do with the future of the nations. And then this was strange, and I wanted to see what you thought. As the world shrinks, and then he stopped, and he regrouped, and he said, it will continue to shrink with an ever-increasing acceleration, thus bringing these places closer. And in the future, I can see a time where it will be very, very important strategically.
Yeah.
Direct quote out of the recording.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're absolutely right, which is very interesting as well, because when I was first delving into this, I had wrote a thing in one of my narratives where I was saying that it everything became a shrinking world. And I wrote that before I even saw his interview. And then after I had done this, people that had watched it, they were telling me that I was starting to give them small world syndrome. And that's the natural reaction. That is absolutely instinct. Once you find out you're an enclosed structure, even though nothing changes, you look up in the sky and everything, nothing changes in your world.
Acceptance has changed.
Yeah. You feel that the world has gotten smaller.
Right.
And it's very interesting that Admiral Byrd would have said that more than once, you know, and
you can tell, again, I think he had to think about that twice and say, oh my God, what did I just say?
Yeah.
Trying to be very careful. The other thing that blew my mind was they had a list. I did a little bit of research on Antarctica.
Yeah.
And it says here, silver, gold, cobalt, copper, chromium, iron, molybdenum, manganese, nickel, lead, titanium, uranium, and zinc. And then, of course, there's just massive amounts of oil as well.
Yeah, I mean, depending on who you talk to, even if you're using the government's map on how big it is a massive continent. You know, if it, at the very least, it is bigger than Australia, you know, and people again, this isn't like an Area 51 situation where you just fence off a thing with scary signs and you put guard dogs and trucks. This is like sealing off a giant the entire continental United States, basically. And putting a multinational navy around it, putting a treaty in place and saying nobody goes there. We're talking about a huge amount of land. And nowadays they're masking it under a veneer treaty, which is an environmental treaty. And of course, people say, well, of course, it's an environmental thing. We care about the penguins. It's like, no, the penguins only live on the coastline, for one. And second, and I might even go with that argument until you realize that treaty was put in place in 1959.
Yeah.
1959, environmentalism wasn't a word. Greenpeace wasn't even founded until 1971. And that was just a couple, you know, guys with tie-dye shirts in a van.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Some boats. So don't tell me, you know, that it's an environmental issue. It is not. And besides, the corporations wouldn't care.
Yeah.
Do you think an oil company is going to care?
Fine, even now, but at least we're a little bit better.
They are absolutely, the petroleum industry is going to get into the Alaskan, you know, state parks if they haven't already. But yet they can't. I know, and that's a sad thing.
That, folks.
But at the same time, they cannot even bring up a press conference to talk about Antarctica.
Well, and okay, so here we've talked about Antarctica, yep. And Admiral Byrd, And yep. Those of you that haven't really dived into the flat Earth theory, you're probably wondering, well, why are you focusing so much on Antarctica? So let's talk to them a little bit about how does that apply? What role does Antarctica play in the flat
Earth? I'm sorry. You're absolutely
right. No, it's not.
Antarctica, okay, in an enclosed model, Antarctica isn't the – you think the globe shape is strange. Antarctica becomes stretched, meaning eventually on an enclosed world, you have to have an outer ring. And if Antarctica is at the South Pole, that becomes stretched to the point where literally it surrounds the entire – oh, I didn't even see you were doing that – the entire outer edge. And if you think I'm just making that up out of thin air, I suggest you go look at the United States Geological Survey azimuthal equidistant map, which is on the wiki list of map projections.
Yeah.
And you will see that very map. In fact, somebody asked me today, you know, it's like, where is that, you know, on the USGS? And I you could go on the government site, and there's various, you know, different pages depending on which document you look at. But it is absolutely confirmed that that's what they use. The United States Geological Survey uses that map that you just showed. And it coincidentally is also the map used by the Flat Earth Society. Only one is considered a legitimate map, and the other one is considered crazy town. And, you know, you wonder why. And I'm sorry, I forgot that too, that the U.S., that map is also the basis for the United Nations flag. You know, that which
right. And that's the most interesting part of all is they've got it in our faces.
Yeah, the United Nations flag is the USGS map, and it also is also the flat Earth map, only the United Nations flag is missing something, and that is it's missing Antarctica.
Yeah. So everybody's clear, Antarctica is actually the outer rim all the way around. Okay.
It is a cold water, cold climate barrier.
And how tall are the walls of ice?
Oh, 2 miles. It's Antarctica is way weirder than people think. Not only, you know, you have to dodge icebergs to get there, but once you get there, it goes almost 2 miles straight up, and it stays at 2 miles. It's so, you know, and that you're pushing 10,000 feet. That's a couple thousand feet above altitude sickness for a lot of people. And then you've got hundreds of miles, we don't know how many, you know, in all directions of nothingness. No plant life, no animal life, no indigenous populations, no ancient ruins that we know of. It is a harsh deterrent, so to speak.
To make sure that no explorers go there. And
exactly.
Speaking of explorers, I know that there's like several. Matt Bulland, is that one of them? Clough, right? What are the explorers that you had brought up? There's in my notes here, I have...
Or which part?
Well, Matt Bulland I have down and Rodney Clough. Apparently, they tried to explore the North and South Poles, and they were threatened, right?
I did not know this, believe it.
What?
You've got something on me. Yeah. I did not know they were threatened.
Interesting. According to the research I have, Rodney was threatened. They actually threatened to shoot him out of the water.
Really?
And they turned him away, so he had to split. Matt Bolin, same thing. And then there's this Muriel Endehay, who also tried, and he was denied. So, you know, for those of you that are wondering, well, why hasn't anybody, you know, explored this? Why hasn't anybody discovered the edges of the world, which are Antarctica? That was the whole reason we're bringing it up in the first place.
It's such a natural process that most people – you got to remember, this system is very well built. The negative reinforcements on the outside and up above, but the outside, it's brilliant, in my opinion. First part is, of course, the fact that the oceans are 3% salt solution, which, you know, reduces ocean discoveries by 95%, which means you have to carry fresh water with you, and that would have completely changed if the waters weren't salty. By the time you get to the outer rim, the temperature drops to, you know, below 15 degrees where salt water starts freezing. You run into icebergs. And then, you know, if you can get past that, you get to that frozen wasteland. But it's a fantastic deterrent. Now, Let's say you want to do that today, right? It's like, oh, cold weather, that doesn't bother us at all. No, there is a multinational navy out there that is going to watch everything you do. Everybody on the ice, they know exactly where everybody is. In fact, there was a thing by the Antarctic, somebody had sent me the Antarctic Board of Tourism recently, that they just put in a new thing regarding remote drones. They won't even let you, because a lot of people are asking, it's like, oh, can I bring my own little, you know, drone to fly around? And they said, nope, nope, you don't want to do that. And, you know, they cover their bases extremely well. They don't leave anything to chance. And again, and you wouldn't, this is what you would expect, because if you're not going to let a corporation down there to make tons of money,
yeah,
you know, that's how far you're willing to go. So as far as civilians doing things on their own, oh, no. No, it may seem like you're not being watched, but you are absolutely being watched.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Now, I would say probably one of the number one most interesting things to research is maps. I've always had a fascination for maps myself as well. Yeah. And you know, just when you were talking about the USGS and how they were formed in 1879, that was kind of an eye-opener to me as far as the way in which you map and how the globe that we use today is based on a map from 500 years ago, 1500s maybe.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. The classroom, the one that's in front of the classroom, the
right.
Mercator map, yeah, that's 500 years old, and that's wrong.
Okay.
Absolutely wrong.
And yet there are maps that they're able to do. And in fact, I just had some information come in this morning where they said that they're able to use a technology where they shoot the radar into the surface of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates extremely accurate map making. To the point where it's so accurate that when you compare that map made, it's very similar to the very old maps that were developed by those that were the ocean farers that were literally creating maps strictly from supposedly traveling the oceans. Now, how is that? that just makes it even weirder. You know?
You're going to have to send me those links, because that's, yeah. If you're going to go down that road, you might as well tell me what the core of the Earth looks like after you've only dug 8 miles.
Right. Well, we'll get into that too. Just so everybody, if you want to research this, he was talking about the azimuthal equidistant projection, right?
Yep.
Isn't that what you were talking about?
Yep.
If you look at this, it's very intriguing. Can you talk to him a little bit about that, the properties of the points of the map, and how basically when people decide to map out a landmass, you have to decide at what point do you start? Now, no one's really, I mean, I haven't really thought of maps this detailed, and that just kind of blew me out of the water.
Yeah, maps are, I'm not going to be able to do it justice. There's some wonderful documentaries on YouTube, but yeah, you're right. It depends. It's not just where you start, but it's the format you're going to use.
Correct.
Which is even weirder. It's almost like, again, because I blame the globe for most of this, because you're trying to create a map off of a three-dimensional object when in reality it's not this sphere. So a perfect example would be the Mercator map versus the Gall-Peters map. The Mercator map was done when they built it. It was done from a point of view from a really European centric point of view to encourage shipping lanes. So all the continents, even though we look at them and they seem perfectly fine, that's not what they look like. So if you compare it to, like, and I'm going to try to talk about this in my next video, which is if you compare that to the Gall-Peters map, when you see it, it's the conditioning thing. Everything proportionally is correct. So South America is way bigger than what we would see on a normal map, and Europe is way smaller. Africa is much bigger. Australia changes size. But the biggest obvious one is, there you go, the biggest one is Greenland up at the top of the map, which on the map you look at in a classroom is actually 17 times smaller than Africa. But you wouldn't know that from the map you're seeing in the classroom. They look about the same size.
Right.
And people have been trying to get this the Gall-Peters map into schools, and they're having a really, really tough time because visually, it's an affront to our conditioning. It's like, look, we don't like looking at this. And I'm even going to include a clip, I think, in the vid, you know, showing the West Wing thing, where, if you ever seen it, where the lady from the president's office, because, you know, they're looking about the education system, and she's looking at the Mercator map, and she goes, what the hell am I looking at, right? And he goes, it's where you've been living all this time. You know, we don't, you know, it's a question of perspective.
You know, I have another just fantastic map here.
Yeah.
Thanks to Steve. And what it does is it actually shows what we think the map looks like because of what we've been taught versus what it really is. Now, check this out. I don't know if you can see that.
Oh, neat.
Isn't that cool?
People should freeze that. That's actually great. Where did you get that?
I don't know. He's just so into this. But look at the difference, folks. The black lines are what we have been told. The green is what it actually is.
Yeah. And I'd like to jump in and say, this isn't even a point of dispute. We all, yeah, ask any scientist. That is exactly what you know, what we are taught versus what actually is, and they won't even let that into schools. So people are saying, oh, you know, how can this globe thing, you know, I'll be right. It's like, are you kidding? They won't even tell you how big the countries really are. You really think they're gonna bend and say, oh yeah, by the way, it's not a globe?
Well, and for those of you wondering how they can get away with this, the main thing is that during the time of you know, exploration and also imperialism, I should use. Yeah.
There you go.
There was definitely a motivation for the smaller countries to appear larger. And don't forget, these guys know the human mind like the back of their hand. I mean, they know how we react and what we feel and how we can create better than we do ourselves. Yeah. You know, thanks to places like the RAND Corporation, the military. Even the prisoner war camps, these are all, and Auschwitz, these are all areas where they've done a massive amount of work on learning how the human mind works and perceives.
Yep.
So they can create this whole Holly weird scenario.
Nice. Nice.
Oh my.
That's a great map though. I'm going to look that up after I'm done.
Now tell everybody about the, I don't even know how to say his name. Abu al-Rahan?
No, don't use his full name.
Okay.
Now, in fact, you're going to screw me up. Okay.
Al-Biruni,
there he is. Yeah, his full name, is Persian, is tough to pronounce.
Okay.
So, yeah, when you go to, again, that was one of those little tidbits, which I love, and, you know, I still get, you know, debunkers come at me. Can't wait. when you look at the azimuthal equidistant map, there's some notes on it, and it's really interesting because in the wiki list of map projections, which is all pretty much grabbed from, you know, different sources, but the azimuthal equidistant map, which is tied to the USGS, which is tied to the UN flag, which is tied to the flat Earth, and all these things, you know, no other map is linked to as many things as this thing is. You look and you think it's a typo because it says, well, when was the map proposed? It was proposed 1000 AD. And you think it's a mistake. And then you look and you see who it was proposed by. And it was proposed by a Persian scientist named Al-Biruni. And you look it up and sure enough, you know, he was the one that came up with this type of model, which was also very interesting because 1,000 years ago, it's when we thought the Earth was flat.
Yeah.
And 1,000 years ago, we didn't even know the complete map. So his model was based on his perception of the globe, you know, sorry, not the globe, the enclosed world, and we hadn't even discovered everything on it yet. And you think, okay, you know, maybe it's still, you know, maybe it's not a modern thing and maybe it's a broken link. And then you look and you see, if you look at it under Al-Biruni, NASA named a moon crater after him.
Wow.
And it's like, seriously? You know, so I don't know who left the USGS link in there, but it's absolutely legit. It's absolutely real.
But that's how they mess with us. They give you just enough information that's actually truth.
Yeah.
And they surround it with a bunch of garbage. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that was interesting about him, he was a mathematician, He was well versed in astronomy, physics, mathematics, yep. natural sciences, and also distinguished as a historian, chronologist, and linguist. Good God.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is really new his stuff. And do you know that he was the creator of geodency?
I did not know that. That's really good.
Hey, isn't this cool that I'm actually teaching?
Seriously. That's how it works. No, you get some good stuff. I like your stuff.
It says here, creator of geodency, which is also known as geodetics, a branch of applied mathematics and earth scientists where the scientific discipline deals with the measurement and the representation of the earth, including its gravitational field, in a three-dimensional time-varying space. He studied the geodynamical phenomena such as crustal motion. I thought that was it. Tides, polar motions, and design global and national control networks using space and terrestrial techniques while relying on diatoms and coordinate systems. Whoa.
Wow. This guy was super smart.
Yeah.
I mean, extremely ahead of his time.
So obviously they definitely had his number.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, you know, they're using his map. He basically described the entire enclosed system 1,000 years ago, and they're still using it to this day. And I several people have mentioned to me, it's like, look, it's in your face on top of it.
It's totally in your face.
Yeah.
So why do you think everything really started getting some momentum with the Flat Earth Society again around 1945? What do you think was like the kicker for that?
Tough to say. I mean, it could have been just dissemination from other places because, like the UN flag, for example, which someone had pointed out to me, which the final version of the UN flag, I think, was in 1946, happened to be the same year that Operation High Jump happened. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think the Flat Earth Society at that point was starting to get – there was some bleed from the secret societies because, you know, not everything. You know, you can keep a secret – pretty much, but there's other things that'll go other places. I have no doubt that before that, there were a whole bunch of secret societies that knew that the Alberoni map was true, and they probably had more detailed maps of their own that showed the edge.
Yeah.
On top of it, but for you know, and so yeah, there seemed to be sort of a fevered pitch for a little while, but then it was kind of like. I'm not gonna have the greatest analogy for it, but. You know how you talk about doing something, you're super psyched up about it, but then it becomes more real than you want it to be? You know, something super scary, like, are we really doing this? You know, that's what I think happened there. And that is, yeah, the powers that be, the authority, they knew what it was like, but they didn't know it for sure, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's still like, it was this myth, it was this legend. So Operation Deep Freeze, and so I think they even jumped the gun. They were like, oh yeah, let's do the UN flag in 1946. We're gonna get way ahead of this. And then in 1956, the Operation Deep Freeze happens. When you see it, then it's like, oh man, this thing's actually real. You know, and then there's this little, it's like, because at that point you have to change gears from a society standpoint. You know, it's like, okay, what do we do? Because now we got to keep this thing under wraps.
Right.
And you know, then it gets really weird. But as far as the societies themselves, I think it was just bleed through from the other groups.
Interesting.
You know?
Well, and the other thing is, let's just say this. There's so much more that came through in World War II because of the momentous impact that it had, not just on us, but on all the beings within this so-called universe, which
yes.
Who knows how to define that these days, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it just seems to me that 1945 was really the turning point for so much of this stuff. Now,
yeah.
do you feel that it was after they made the discovery through Byrd's mission down there?
Yeah.
Do you feel at that point there was a lot of aggression in clamping the whole Flat Earth theory shut?
Massive.
Okay.
Massive. Because everybody went into freak out mode almost immediately. There were moves being made that didn't make any sense until you started putting them all together. And that was, so 1956, Operation Deep Freeze ends. But between 1955 and 1956, you find something. Something so huge, you know, something so jaw-dropping that you not only can you not come up with a cover story for it, but you lock down the, you know, the entire continent. But that takes a few years. Right after that, in 1957, the United States and Russia, who, you know, left the ice at the same time, you know, people say, oh, you know, we've been enemies, Cold War, blah, blah, blah. No. United States and Russia have been in on it since day one. Everything that they do, they talk to each other. Yes, at the lower ranks, fine, you can say whatever, but the United States and Russia at the highest levels were in on this because they had to be. One country could not pull this off by themselves, and they knew it. Everybody had to be, you know, it was a combined effort, but mostly it was the United States and Russia. They both started up their rocket programs in 1957, you know, with a fevered pitch. You know, it's like, we've got to get this thing, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to create the space race, right? That'll get, you know, people going naturally because it didn't make any sense. And then within a year after those first rockets going up, they decide, well, yeah, we're going to put nukes on the top of them and start firing them straight up. And they did that for, you know, they did that starting in 1958. In 1958, literally within the first three shots that they took, the United States took, because Russia had to catch up a little bit, they formed NASA immediately in 1958. And then shortly after that, in 1959, they locked down Antarctica. But NASA, when it was formed, was really the militarization of space. It was, they had to control the skies, and that was the best, that was an outstandingly big, broad move by the United States part, because at that point they controlled all science aspects regarding space. If you were an engineer and you were a scientist and you wanted to deal with space for the next 40, 50 years, you had to go through NASA. And while they, so again, you know, rocket program, firing nukes, form NASA, lock down Antarctica, turn around, keep firing nukes until 1962, when Russia and the United States both stop on the exact same day, and they say, oh, it's a moratorium. No, it wasn't a moratorium. They were done. They were done mapping the whole thing out. It took them 4 years to figure out where everything was up there. And then once they stopped firing, then they decide, oh, yeah, we're going to do the moon program. And, you know, then they...
Is there anything to show what they found out? I mean, are there any maps that reflect what they found the firmament to be?
All we know, unfortunately, all we have are the public records of the shots fired and the supposed altitudes that they were sent to. And you can look these up. They're in Wiki. You know, everything that I did wasn't referenced, you know, by some weird site. It was mostly, you know, standard Wiki stuff you can find, although I'm sure you could find some government stuff on it.
I'm laughing, Mark, because, you know, I even got an email this morning. Well, you know, Wikipedia is owned by the network.
Oh, fine. So, yeah, of course. I got you.
Necessarily just trust that either, you know.
But at the same time, you still got to believe, you know, they release stuff every once in a while, I think, because they think it's the right thing to do. And it haunts them, you know, way later. Oh, I'll give you another example. The Van Allen radiation belt, discovered by a NASA employee in 1959, the exact same year you locked down Antarctica. And the Van Allen radiation belt, the message was, oh, yeah, there's something super deadly above you. Oh, no, it's not a dome. It's just a big layer of radiation that nobody can go through. And that backfired on them because in 1959, that was still 10 years before the first moon shots, right? So they had 10 years to figure out a technology to get through this imaginary radiation belt that they had created. But it wasn't long enough because they realized the only way to get through radiation is some heavy lead shielding, and they couldn't put it on the capsules because it would make it too heavy. So they just sent the capsules anyway and decided, well, we just won't talk. They just trailed off. It's like, oh, we're just not going to talk about it, right? Six moon missions back and forth through this, you know, supposed radiation belt, and nobody died without shielding. And, you know, you can go on YouTube, and there's great new stuff that's coming out, even this month, where – there's NASA guys that are going on television and saying, yeah, we got to deal with this radiation problem. It's like, what are you talking about? You already dealt with it 50 years ago. So what are you talking about it now for?
You know, it's interesting. There's actually a video out where the guy swears that the water within the nuclear power plants is perfectly safe to swim in.
Really?
I'm not kidding. He challenges everyone. He actually worked there for decades.
Was this American or Russian?
American.
Really?
I believe he was on the East Coast. I'd have to track it down. It's on my website if you
Google. Okay, I'll check it out, absolutely.
You know, work with the search engine.
Sure.
But now, on your Status Quo series, you know, basically you go over the 500 years ago and the perception of the Earth and how it, you know, used to be flat and then it turned round and they went into the whole global thing.
Yep.
And the Treaty of Antarctica and that was off limits.
Yep.
And you were talking about the astronauts were sworn to secrecy under the penalty of whatever. Now, yep. The moon missions were launched. What is your perception of how many actual moon missions really made it to the moon?
None. I don't trust the moon missions have been so. And again, don't take my word for it. There are a bunch of documentaries out there. Every year, the internet makes the moon missions sillier and sillier to look at, to the point where I'll even take it one step further. A site that I ran into recently, which is, and you can Google this, is the third party evidence of Apollo missions, which is basically NASA has gotten so beat up about this. You know, it's so just hammered on this that they had to release a secondary wiki entire section that says, don't take our word for it. Here are independent people, independent countries that have nothing to do with NASA. Literally, they say it's at the top of the page. Nothing to do with NASA or the U.S. government that can confirm we went to the moon. I've never seen such backpedaling in all my life. It's like at this point, they're just holding on by their fingernails, trying to keep this thing afloat, and it is not working. No. Moon missions, no. Never, ever, never, never, never happened.
So for everyone listening, I know there are so many disagreements on this topic. I can't begin to tell you how many people do not agree on this. Some people feel like there were about six that were made. Some people feel that only one made it. And then there's some that feel that none. So I would challenge anyone out there that can really come up with the testimony to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt whether we really did make it to the moon or not. Because yeah. I know that it's you know, it was all manipulated. Now, let's talk a little bit about planefinder.net. I thought
Plane
that
Finder.
Was really interesting.
Planefinder.net and Flight Radar 24 are real-time tracking systems that track planes all over the world. And when I was looking for, there was if it is an enclosed system, there are three rules you cannot break. One, of course, is the space program is an absolute sham. Two, there can't be any actual photographs of the Earth from space. But the third one, which is also very interesting, is that on an enclosed system, there cannot the plane routes in the southern hemisphere are not going to be correct because of the map you're looking at. If the map is literal, here's the difference. The USGS will look at the azimuthal equidistant map and they'll say, oh, it's just a projection. But from a flat Earth standpoint, it's literal, which means there are two places on that map where plane flights will be wrong. And I mean very, very wrong. And that is South America and Australia, because they are literally at the opposite ends of the map. And on a globe, there, you know, you can take shortcuts because it's a globe, it's a sphere. Australia to South America, 7,400 miles, piece of cake, no sweat, goes around across the South Pacific. But if you tried to get these flights, if you try to book these flights from these two points, and they should be very, very easy, they bounce you all over the place. The most notable one is if you like going from Sydney to Buenos Aires, they bounce you off Los Angeles. And it makes no, or San Francisco, and it makes no sense unless you're looking at a flat map. If you're looking at a flat map, it's almost an exact straight line.
Right.
And this happens all the time, you know, or going for, you know, they'll bounce you off Dubai, or they'll take you in weird places. In fact, a video came out just yesterday, a brand new one, where a guy had it'll say like airplane routes exposed, and it's very, very good, where a guy shows little hidden refueling points where planes look like they're going nonstop, but they actually go off and they refuel real quick, and then they come down, and there's lots of little posts. Social media is screwing this all up for these guys, because people will say, oh, hey, I didn't expect this stop in this city. We stopped at blah, blah, blah. And you only have to see so many of those. And on top of that, so people were bugging me, and they were saying, oh, yeah, there's nonstops. You know, again, people's logic drives me nuts, because it's like, you don't understand that 95% of the flights in the Southern Hemisphere are connections, which shouldn't happen anyway. This is 2015. You can get nonstops anywhere. Ask the Northern Hemisphere. But when you watch these flights, or any flights in the Southern Hemisphere, anything below the equator, if you look on planefinder.net, those flights will disappear.
And I have to tell you, Mark, this happened to me. I just came back from South Africa last year, and I was looking for the most direct flight from LAX to South Africa.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, you know, they took you to Boston, they took you to New York City, and then they took you to Heathrow. Okay, that's kind of your choices. Well, then I started looking, maybe I should take a flight to South America, because it was like right across the ocean from Africa.
Sure.
Well, it was about $1,000 to $1,500 more, even though it was less mileage. And I thought, okay, well, you know, they'd probably use the excuse, it's not as common of a route, right?
Yeah.
Well, then I thought, okay, well, let me see what else I can do, you know, going from there to Heathrow. Well, they wanted to take me over to Dubai, which is way over here compared to where I wanted to go here. I was like, what is that about?
Yeah, Dubai seems to be a common thread, yeah.
And I went into the same thing, so I had to bring that up.
And I'd like to also add that this problem is software, and it eventually will be fixed, which is why I mentioned at the end of the video. People are saying, "Oh, you should have told them," because it's like, look, you have to get it out there, because eventually they're going to plug this hole sooner or later, because the GPS system is not a public system; it is a Department of Defense, United States military system.
Glad you brought that up.
As this gets enough attention, they are going to figure out a way to plug this hole.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm still leaving the videos up, though, as a record.
So for all of you listening, if you really want to dive into this, now's the time to do it. If we can find any holes in the you list like 5 or 6 different companies that provide the logging of the planes.
Oh, yeah.
And he says it's kind of like watching, you know, paint dry. But
well, actually, it's not as bad as you might think, because the planes disappear before you get bored. Watching boats, that's like watching paint dry.
I just think that's such a trip. Now, talk a little bit about the ceiling of the dome.
Okay. Everything that I've seen, you know, people have asked me, it's like, oh, how high is it, and what is it made of? The ceiling of the dome, the best I can tell is, you know, If it goes up higher than 400 kilometers, yeah, sure, maybe. But it seems to be, again, projected on from the outside. It prohibits space travel pretty much entirely. Yeah, planes can fly up, you know, because planes cap out at 10 miles. Spy planes cap out at, well, depending on who you talk to, because we're not even supposed to even – spy planes don't even exist right now, but they do.
Oh, yeah, right.
At maybe like 20 miles. It really depends, but it's for me, it's not the snow globe thing where you've got, you know, where it's super, super high arced, and you wouldn't need that for something like this. It'd be actually be a relatively low arc by, you know, from an efficiency standpoint, and from best I can tell, impenetrable, or if there is an opening, it's guarded.
And so people are thinking it's 10 miles.
No. That's just, well, some people will say that. Again, that is in dispute, but it's like, look, you're not going to make, if you're building something like this from a creator standpoint, you're not going to interfere with
make it too low.
Yeah, because again, commercial airliners can get up to 10 miles.
Yeah.
And spy planes, you know, if we're talking, you know, the Aurora project nowadays, that one, you know, should be able to get up around 20 miles or so. But I don't trust anything that's on a rocket as far as getting up there. But I have no doubt that the government knows how full well how high it is.
You know, now speaking of the rockets, there is footage up there about one rocket and missile after another going up and exploding.
Yeah, and that started back years ago during the high altitude nuke tests. In fact, one test, which I love the name that they chose, was Operation Fishbowl. And it's like, why would you
That's
name?
Interesting.
Yeah, that was a package of tests that they did. It's like, really? So like the first one was called Hard Tack, and then the next one, the Americans, and because the Russians don't name it like we do. And then the next one we did was called Operation Fishbowl. It's like, why would you name? Why would you name it like that? Why would you? But yeah, rockets fail all the time, and to the point where I would not surprise me at all if astronauts were ever put on the top of rockets. It'd be way, you know, I don't think I'd even take that chance if I was doing a space program.
I was just blown away, Mark, how many there were. I mean, it was like a couple of them in 1960, 1963, 1965. Let me see. I have it. 1958, 1959, 1960 twice, 1961, 1965, 1986 twice, three times, 1991, 96 twice, 98, 2007, and 2013.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
And that's the government sector. The private sector, you know, there's only two private space programs currently running right now. I think it's SpaceX and Virgin Airways. I can't remember what they call theirs, but those programs aren't going anywhere. You know, there's little things that NASA does. You know, one is they release news on pretty much a monthly basis. I've never seen a corporation or a government agency release as much news as NASA does on a regular basis, to the point where, you know, we had scheduled this interview a while back, and like 2 days ago, they just announced, like, oh yeah, Russia and America, joint mission to Mars, and we're going to build another, you know, ISS space station, in addition to the one that's already up there. And they do that to reinforce this.
Yeah.
It is strictly to say, we're up there, you're down here. We're up there, you're down here. And it's like, really? You're talking about a Mars? That Mars mission's never going to happen. Never. Because they can't. From a production standpoint, and I know people have heard me say this before, it's like, look, moviemistakes.com and all the other sites that all they do is track movie mistakes that happen in any piece of film. That there are nerds out there that literally go frame by frame on any piece of media, and they will look for the mistakes. You cannot fake a mission to Mars. I'm telling anybody that's thinking of doing that right now, you can't do it. If you try to do it, you will be shredded. It cannot be done. You thought the moon missions were blown apart? Mars, you wouldn't even get to land before they started tearing you guys up.
Interesting. So, why is it so much more drastically difficult to
because the public has access to stuff now that we didn't do in the past.
Okay.
Like when they did the moon missions, they had no idea the pictures were going to be analyzed on such a broad scope in such resolution, to where, again, you got somebody in Missouri at 3 o'clock in the morning that'll find something. You know, the internet hive mind is total when it comes to finding. It may take them a while, but they will find everything. And now that, you know, and it just gets worse, meaning the technology that the public has now is actually almost caught up with what they would have to try to fake. So I'll use the Interstellar example. You know, that Interstellar, that movie that was released just last year. You know, I look at it, and, you know, he's going to give his daughter the watch. The watch is on his hand. It says 3 o'clock. The very next scene, he's taking the watch off. It now says 8:20. I caught that in 5 seconds, and that's a multi-million dollar movie. The government doesn't have nearly the quality control that Hollywood does, and that's why they get caught on all this stuff. And they just can't. I recommend anyone thinking about trying to fake a Mars mission at this point, just pack it in. Retire early.
I love it. Well, now you had alluded to bringing up drilling down within the Earth. Since we can't successfully go up, and discover the firmament and discover the fact that we're inside this so-called glass-type covered dome over the flat Earth, then a lot of people have said, well, then let's go ahead and go down and see what we find. So can you go ahead and...
The wool that has been pulled over your eyes is complete in all sectors, including what, you know, not only, you know, if you believe in the globe, they also, the scientists will also have to tell you how it's built, literally from end to end. And everyone knows, and I included this in one of my videos called Depth Perception, which says, you know, we all know that the ever brighter bands of molten material that's supposed to be in our globe, but people don't understand that no public company has drilled below, and it was the Russians that did it first, drilled below, I think the Germans did it second, the deep core drilling, they only went 8 miles down. And if this globe is 8,000 miles thick, how are you telling me what the Earth looks like if you can only go 8 miles down? And from a design standpoint, it's also very, very good because, yes, people, you know, all the population's down the ground, and we like digging. We dig for just about anything. So you don't want people to start digging, you know, that old joke, oh, I'm going to dig to China, you know, that because it actually wouldn't be China. It'd be somewhere else if it was in America. But, in fact, you'd just dig into an ocean.
You're talking about this one, right? Can you see it?
Yeah. And that took years. It took years to do. So when you get down that far to 8 miles, the temperature reaches the point where the drill bits really just start turning into clay and they can't do anything with it. And so it's like, all right, well, we're done. So at 8 miles, because people ask me, it's like, well, how thick would the model have to be? And it's like, no, not very. Since, you know, the general population can't go below 8 miles, you could make it less than 100 miles thick, which is actually really thin compared to, you know, the width of it. And you'd still be able to do your things. And people would say, well, you know, what about the natural processes of lava and molten rock and volcanoes? I'm going, you gotta understand that in a system this large, if it is artificial, creating a molten rock system, not that hard to do. Giant blast furnaces, pipes that can pump it through. The only thing you hope for is that people don't, you know, make cities next to volcanoes, which has happened in the past. You know, and it wouldn't, again, it wouldn't be that hard to do. Plus, that system also generates an extra amount of heat, similar to a heated seat in a car. So the temperature system, it could augment that as well. It's very efficient on all levels. So no, not a natural process for me.
356 degrees Fahrenheit is what
at 8 miles.
At what they reached at 8 miles. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like.
And then they quit. And then they said, and the Germans tried the same thing, and they quit. And yeah, there could be some military classified programs that could maybe blast through, you know. But even they, again, it's classified. You know, how far down can you go with nukes? You know, can just keep, you know, blowing holes down there. You might be able to get down to a certain point, but at that point, you're not going to tell people what's down there anyway.
Well, it's interesting that there have been some intel coming out regarding the mining of gold, and some of the people that are coming out of these mines, you know, they're basically saying, I'm never doing this again because it's so incredibly hot.
Yeah.
They've gotten so deep into the, you know, the crevices of the earth, supposedly, they can't handle it. I loved it when you said the car is made out of melted, reformed, polished rock.
Yeah. It's one of those things that's lost on people because they forget that we have technology to do some of this stuff right now. And melting rock, that's the easy thing. You know, we drive around in it every day. That's all cars and anything metal is just, you know, the soft parts of rock that we melted down and reformed. You scale that up, we could simulate a volcano if we wanted to. I know we could.
That's a really good point. It's something I had never thought of, so I want to commend you on that one.
I did that totally sober.
One of my favorite parts of Mark's series is under the souls in the system, and I want to just play like a 2-minute clip, if you don't mind, Mark.
Okay. Are you going to play it right now, or are you just going to cut to it? Okay.
Yeah, we're just going to play it right now and then come back in just a sec. I just thought that this was so outstanding. I'm not even going to say anything more. Let's just listen for a minute.
the better if the enclosed system was revealed? Would you lie to hurt someone? Would you rob a bank, commit fraud, or embezzle? Would you steal anything unless your life depended on it? And while people would still get angry and fight, would they maim each other? Would they kill? Would anyone knowingly commit murder? Would you bully or extort people for profit? In fact, knowing that the world was created, would you do anything malicious towards anyone? If the world is not a globe, but instead enclosed, then wars end. Hate crimes end. Maybe not overnight, but quickly. Because you may be, for the first time in your life, actually accountable for your actions. You realize now that you are a very real soul in this enclosed system, and you have a responsibility towards your fellow man, one that can be boiled down into one simple rule: treat others better than you treat yourself. This is why it's so important to show the world as it really is. This is why I am asking the authority itself to open the door and let this secret come through. You've kept this hidden for too long, and the people who live here with you have been through enough. This isn't about money or power anymore. It's about our very souls, the essence of who we are. Wealth and titles don't define your heart. Hiding the entire world may have seemed like a good idea at the time, but we have gone way beyond that. Have you actually seen our home recently? This needs to be fixed, and it needs to be now. The people won't forget the deception, but they will forgive you for it, because a truth like this will make them more noble, something we should have been since the beginning.
That was spectacular.
Thank you.
I mean, that must have been one of your moments of spiritual bliss. Seriously.
Yeah, it was. I didn't...
Beautifully stated.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm a little...
No, it is.
I hadn't actually listened to that one for a little while. It was... when I wrote it, when I initially went down that path with, talking about the astronauts, I got to a point where I had changed my mind about, I took the positive approach and said, look, this can be something very, very good. This could be something great for us if it's allowed to happen. And I firmly believe that. You know, when I was writing it, I didn't even hesitate. It was like, everything I said just built on itself, and to the point where by the time I got to the end, I absolutely was convinced that everything I was saying was the right thing.
Oh, it was beautifully said. And
thank
seriously,
you.
I'm glad that you presented it in such a way where, hey, let's not focus on this being a conspiracy. Let's focus on why this type of information needs to come out.
Yeah.
And we need to raise our awareness about just it being a possibility, if not.
Yeah.
Else.
Yeah. And I didn't want, and again, I hate giving messages to the authority directly, but look, this is their chance. And they could turn this world around if they just let it happen.
Exactly.
And it is one of the few things, again, in the conspiracy world, there's so much negativity and there's so much, darkness. And it's like, if this actually happened, especially with the social media, the speed it could get around, I think it'd be such a fantastic shock to the system that everybody would just walk outside and they'd look at each other differently.
Yeah, and we'd have peace and we would be living unified and accepting each other, no matter what we look like. No matter who we are and what we do for a living, that's where we're moving. And that's the coolest part about Mark is I see that spiritual element in him. He's truly been he's been guided and directed to present this information. And this is in no way, shape, or form trying to not acknowledge the work of Eric Dubai, because he has done some phenomenal work. Please check him out as well. His last name is Dubay, who has really done some very tenacious work on presenting the more scientific approach to the flat Earth.
Yeah.
This is really something that interests you as much as it does me. One last thing, because we are getting to the top of the 2-hour mark.
Sure.
You know, I thought it was really interesting. There was one video out there, Mark, and I'm not sure if you know which one I'm talking about, where it talks about how the rays of the sun, if the sun is so far away, then the rays of the sun would be bent, and they would be different than the way they appear today. And they were basically saying how the sun really is just much more above us, or it's not so much that the sun is setting, it's that it's just getting further away at the horizon.
Yeah.
And one of the videos was outstanding because it actually showed the all-seeing eye. And I had a big aha when I saw that. What do you think of
that? Well, you mean against the guy that made that particular one? Okay, I will say, look, I subscribe to his channel. I know exactly what you're talking about. The channel's name is My Perspective. The guy's name is Rory Cooper, and I actually talked to him on the phone a couple weeks ago. I'm pretty sure he's down in South Africa. And regardless of, again, you know, regardless of what he put out there, you know, if there's an image that seems out of place, he does give some very, very interesting takes on the three-dimensional look.
Yeah.
If you can get your head around it, he doesn't do a narrative. He just uses some text, but he does it from an artistic point of view with a lot of three-dimensional positioning.
Yes.
And it is very interesting. Check it out, because, yes, and I've saved a couple on my machine where he goes into a lot into sun angles and how things should look and things we take for granted, optical illusions which we completely miss, and hopefully I'll talk about it in Clue 12. But again, if you can stay with him, you know, and pause it, rewind it, watch it again. Don't watch it through and say he's totally lost me, because you're not. He's trying to show you something that's literally right in front of you, that what should be, especially when it comes to sun rays and angles, and how on a globe it should look like this, and on a flat system it should look like this. He'll go and he'll compare the two. He'll go, look, this is what it should happen if this is what it is, and from the other side, this is what I'm seeing. He goes, tell me that I'm wrong, and it's somewhat controversial, because again, it's not exactly scientific like Eric Dubay's stuff. You know, Eric fills in a lot of holes that I don't.
Yeah.
But Rory's stuff is really interesting from a visual standpoint. You know, it's all eyes. So, yeah, I recommend it. Totally, you know, check it out. I don't know if he's got any hidden things in there. I hope not. Rory, if you're listening to this, please don't. But
oh, my gosh. You're so funny. Well, so one last thing, if somebody wants to come up and say to you, oh, you're ridiculous, the Earth can't be flat because you have to consider the law of similarities and everything is spherical, what would you say? Quick.
Okay. Oh, yeah, quick. Sorry. We're out of time. Think of it from this standpoint. If it is an enclosed system, the builders or creators are going to be very, very clever. To the point where I firmly believe at some point they wanted the globe illusion to happen. But it was going to be as a natural process, because if the globe illusion happens, we don't run for the fence. We don't immediately dedicate our entire lives to beating on the fence or the wall or the barrier or the firmament and try to say, hey, who's on the other side of this? If it's a globe, we don't even look for it. But I think as a natural process, I think we were supposed to discover it by ourselves, maybe in the 50s, maybe in the 60s, depending on when we actually got out there. You know, who knows? If Bird wasn't forced out there, when would he have actually found it? But I think from that point forward, it has been artificial. The globe was supposed to be discovered decades ago, and it was hidden from us.
So from
the spherical point of view, yes, everything in the sky is spherical because that's part of the illusion. We're supposed to think that. Because as soon as we build this, everything else becomes spherical. It doesn't become a plane anymore. The sun becomes a sphere. The moon becomes a sphere. All the planets become spheres. Everything becomes a sphere instantly, and it stays that way until somebody else tells us otherwise.
Good point. Well, thank you, Mark. Just so in case everybody did not remember, please access Mark Sargent's Flat Earth Clues 1 through 11, and he has some other videos up there on YouTube.com. You can also, I'm going to let you give out your phone number. You can also reach Mark at msargent23@comcast.net. And yep, he is bold enough to put his home phone number, which is?
It's 303-494-6631. I put that phone number at the end of every video, and yes, that's the phone right here. That's the phone. It's a landline. You can't text it. But I will leave that phone on until it is it stopped blowing up, to the point where, you know, eventually I'll have to shut the ringer off and just answer messages. But it's been wild so far.
Well, and one of the other things I really like about the approach that you have is he's really open to all of us submitting additional data, any other tidbits that you feel will fill in some of the blanks. Okay.
Oh yeah, I don't have all
together. We're all basically trying to swim through the murky waters to find out what's really our truth here, and so I commend you, Mark. Thank you so much for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So anyway, we're running out of time. I just wanted to say thanks to everybody. As always, you know how much I love you, and I appreciate you guys are the best audience. Your emails really keep me inspired and going and supported. So please know that ahead of time. Also, don't hesitate to contact me if you have any questions on the implant removal series, which is literally the best, I believe, in the world, and also my alchemical galactic formulas, which are just a whole new ride of its own. So anyway, take care, have a wonderful evening, and we will talk to you on what? The other side? No. Outside the firmament?
Ah.
I don't know what to say, but anyway, you guys have a wonderful rest of the week. Thank you, Mark, again. I appreciate all that you're doing as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Everybody, lots of love. Take care.